Hello and welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. I am Lize Gathandwa, the digital politics editor at the Sunday Times. It has been over 5 months since South Africans experienced the darkness of load shedding, the longest period in a while. Joining me in this episode is Eskom's chairperson, Mteto Nyati, to talk about various issues concerning the utility and most of all, how we came to a point where we didn't have load shedding.
I will not renew my membership of the EFF. I also request to resign all positions in the EFF.
We are not going to have a parallel government run by hell and sin. There's one president here, and that president is Cyril Ramaphosa.
Bavas J.
Marikana. Marikana.
J.
Honorable members, be in order.
Those who are involved in state capture, action will be taken.
Does that include the top seven?
No.
Why does it not?
Don't start trouble. Nobody's going to announce tomorrow. The results are not correct. If that happens, people will be provoking.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theater for him.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
Who are blown but not out.
Chair, thank you so much for joining us. We've been itching to talk to you about this recovery. I just said to you, you've become this Jesus of our time where you've just, you know, performed this miracle that we were not expecting. I remember not so long ago, your tweet after a certain newspaper wrote something around diesel consumption. I think you'll know it's a weekly newspaper. You'll know that newspaper. I was still there, by the way. I was still in that newspaper. But the assumption for most of us during the election period was that Eskom is burning diesel to ensure that the ANC gets to a position where they come back and govern.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done something that we didn't expect.
Yes.
When you look at your time at Eskom, when you went into this decision to actually become the chair of Eskom, when the president called you to become the chair of Eskom, what were you thinking?
So when I got the call to, in fact, the call was not really about me being the chair. It was almost 2 years ago. They wanted me to be the CEO of Eskom. And so I had to have that discussion with the president, which kind of gave him the view that, you know, what is required at that point was to have people that are supporting Andre, you know, and let's not look at Andre and think that the problems of Eskom are because of Andre, just because they are surfacing when he is there. Generally, when you look at all complex systems, you know, there's this thing called time delay, where between something being done and the consequences of that, there's time delay. So then things surface around you, people think that it is you. It's not always the case, you know. And he appreciated that, and then he said, "Look, then if you are, would you be open to serving on the board?" Which, of course, I said I would be able to. I would like to do that. And the reason why anybody would accept that is you need to reflect on yourself and ask yourself the question: when I look at the problems of this company, what is it in my experience that I think can help? You know, is there something of value that I would bring into the whole equation? And when I look at that and I look at the challenges that I've faced, you know, many of the turnaround that one has done in Altron, in MTN, Microsoft, and some of the time that I spent overseas running operations, I felt that there's so much that one can bring into the Eskom environment. So for me, you know, the only issue that I was having, saying I had left my previous job to concentrate in my own business. So this is probably going to take so much of my time. So that was the big issue. So that's when I made the decision that I need to step off a number of boards. I used to sit on the board of Nedbank. I used to sit on the board of Telkom. And I used to also sit on the board of Massmart, you know, the Walmart company. So I decided to resign from those boards so that I can really put a lot more focus. You know, when I'm committed to something, I commit fully. So, but the good thing as well is that they assembled a board that it was made out of people that really, none of them were politically connected.
Okay.
These were people that were bringing technical expertise into the role.
Was that important to you?
That was very important because... I mean, I was never asked whether which party, you know, do you belong to. The discussion that I was having with both Mr. Pravin Gordhan and the president was really about the turnaround. So the focus was, we need you, you know, and the, you know, your experience and your skills. And that was important to me because when you have to work with people, you need to work with people that have got something that this organization needed. And when I look at the first time they brought all of us together, I was pleasantly surprised and looking forward very much to working with this group of people. You know, these were experts in human resources. These were experts in terms of financial management, CAs, engineers, and, you know, consultants when it comes to legal, you know, very, very smart people that all of them, you know, they never signed up for this thing. They were approached, you know, and yeah, it was really good to be part of a group of people that, okay, they signed up because they wanted to make a difference to their country. That's the key thing.
I suppose the relationship between the board, most especially the chair of the board, and the CEO is equally important.
Very important.
How have you managed, you know, that relationship?
Yes.
Did you know each other prior to this in the business world? And when you got into that position and that seat, what were the conversations that you had to ensure that your relationship doesn't disintegrate because of your own opinions and how ESCOM should be steered?
Yeah. So let me just take a step back and look at the process of recruiting the CEO, because it is so important that we bring that into this discussion. For us, it was important to get a CEO that would connect with the challenges of ESCOM. And the challenges of ESCOM, as much as they are technical, but they are largely people-oriented. You know, they are, it's really about the people. So if you are coming with, you can be the great engineer, but if you do not know how to work and lead people, you are always going to be failing. So it's not really about, it's about, the key is about the leadership side of things. It helps that one would be an engineer. It would help because you need to understand what the issues are technically, and when people are feeding information up the line, you need to be able to say, is this right or wrong, you know? But if you do not know, you just take whatever they're giving you, you know? So so we had to go through a process, a long process of finding the CEO. So I was part of the committee that was doing the interviews. So I met Dan during those interviews, you know, and I did not, it was not the first time, somebody that I knew him from far, and but I'm always aware of the work that he does. And so he came through the interviews like everybody else. And we had a way of looking, because we were very, very, very clear about what the challenges are of this business. And so looking at the people, we're evaluating them against these challenges. So he was one of the three people that stood out for us, you know. And but he was by far the leading candidate. And so I did not know him, but when I look at the chemistry that we have, I have huge amount of respect for him. And that's very important. You know, it's not, which means that I will never try to be a CEO.
Yeah.
You know, because that's another problem. Many people sitting on the board, what they do, they overreach, they try to run the company. I have no desire to do that. Plus, I have a huge amount of confidence and respect for the person, and knowing that he's going to be able to do what we ask him to do, or what the business requires, you know. So that chemistry is very, very important. And the level of trust as well, because one of the things that we did in his first 100 days in the company, we felt that he needed to have the space. Before he engages with you guys in the media, he needs to know what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So we said, look, you need to spend, you know, the first 100 days looking under the bonnet, looking and understanding what the issues are of this business, you know. And during those 100 days, the chairman, meaning myself, I would be the face of the company, engage with the media. So other people would not have accepted that kind of an arrangement. I'm the CEO. Mm. I need to be.
Yes.
But what are you going to talk about?
Yes.
Because you have not been in this environment. So that thing that for him to trust that I can represent the company and I won't mess things up, all of that. So you're asking about the relationship. It is absolutely critical all the time, you know.
How critical is that relationship between you and the president? Because I just thought about that as well.
I have. There is no relationship. I don't have any relationship with the president. Mm-hmm. He just called me. And I think some people clearly must have pointed him towards me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he just went. He's the one who was tasked with trying to convince me, but there is no relationship whatsoever.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, you introduced Mr. Andre Direita, but I was going to introduce him much later. But I just wanted to hear your opinion. There's something that Mr. Gwede Mandasha said to me in 2022, and it stayed with me. Mm. I think let's leave aside whether there was, the political influence and so forth, and an overreach on the ANC's part in terms of ESCOM. But he said something around that Mr. Direita at the time was not the fixer that ESCOM needed, that there were different CEOs for different times in a company, and in a company where you need someone who is going to pull it, in its bootstraps, and you need to pull it from a brink of collapse. You need someone who's a fixer, who's known as someone who understands how to pick up a company. And he didn't feel that he was necessarily that. Mm. I wonder if you think of yourself as a fixer.
I think when you look at the roles that I've occupied in the past, most of those roles revolves around turning things around, taking things that are not working and getting them to a point where, you've got an organization that is performing perfectly well, and that to me, I always say that I'm attracted to roles which are, something is in a mess. Mm-hmm. Where there's a mess, that's where you'll find me. And that's just me. That's being self-aware. We all need to know who we are, and that's why when you get that call, so ask yourself, is it in line with who I am? Mm-hmm. The kind of person, does it have the characteristics of the things that I'm attracted to? When I wake up this morning, in the morning, will I be looking forward I have to do that. And when I looked at that, it had all of the key elements, this challenge of ESCOM, of the things that I'm attracted to. It's probably the same thing with when we listened to Dan as well, when we were doing the interviews, saying, why would you sign up for, you have read all of the stories about, here is the CEO that's leaving and all of these stories, and yet you have raised your hand. Why? It's exactly the same thing. Some people are attracted to go and fix things that are not working. So it's very important to get people that connect with that, And he is that, I am that. And I also think most of the board members are that. Otherwise they would not have signed up for something like this. Yeah.
You know, it's 152-153 days today without load shedding. By next week, it will be 160 days. And you've
said... At some point, it's going to be a year.
When are you going to actually... Why are you so reluctant to say that you've ended load shedding?
Because all of this, there's a science as well behind this. As much as I was talking largely about people and all of that, but there's, if you dig deeper, there's science behind it. Mm. We are where we are, exactly where we thought we would be at this time. You know, about 18 months ago, when we set up this generation recovery plan, we set out a two-year plan and say in 2 years, we'll be able to get to an energy availability factor of 70%. At that time, we feel that we will be able to declare that there's not going to be any load shedding. We are 18 months or so into that plan, you know, and that the end of the 2 years is going to be March 2025. You know? So for me, we still have this the actions that we are taking that needs to take us to where we thought we would be in 2025.
That's the day you were talking about.
Yes, yes. We have to take, execute these actions. And we have, I mean, if you were listening to our press conference yesterday, you could almost feel like we're giving indications that we feel that everything is moving in the right direction. End of load shedding is near. We're saying that because we can see we are exactly where we thought we would be. And if things go according to that, at the end of the 2 years, we should be in a position to say that. But right now, we need to execute the remaining aspects of the recovery plan.
I'm going to be controversial, Chair, and ask, do you think Mr. Direita was the right man for the job?
It's not for me to answer that question. I cannot judge. I was not with him for a long time to be able to answer that question. But what I have seen in many in situations, for example, what he did was to bring a chief operating officer, somebody that understood the things that he may not have understood himself. So he found a way of balancing, you know. So through that setup, it gives you the ability to be able to do what you need to do, you know. And for the company to have allowed him to put a chief operating officer, it's probably a good thing. But yeah, I cannot tell whether he was good or not so good.
I think I'm going to go back to your press conference yesterday, where you were talking about municipalities and, and the bloated amount of money that they are owing to you. I think it's around
82 billion rand.
82
now.
Billion, and it's
just continues to
and it continues grow. To grow. And the minister of Electricity and Energy has said that this money is irrecoverable. What happens now?
I'm not sure whether that statement is correct because the Minister of Electricity is the one who is working very closely with us to find a solution to this problem. And he would not be putting the kind of energy that he's putting into this if he felt that it is something that's not recoverable. Mm. We need to find a solution to this problem, and in one way or the other, you know, because the sustainability of Eskom really largely depend on us finding a solution to this problem, and he is one of those people who. It's quite passionate, you know, and you can see the energy is passionate. And I can see as well that some of the members of the cabinet have also, enrolled themselves in finding a solution to this problem. That's really what we want because it's not going to be one party that address this. Mm. It could be a combination of departments together with Eskom, together with the municipalities themselves that we can help us to get over this problem. But certainly certainly, when I look at his actions, these actions are not of someone who believes that he's just wasting effort.
Let me ask you then, if you think it's if you can be able to recover the monies that are owed to you. I mean, if you even
I think possibly now I'm just thinking for him. If that's what you're saying is accurate, maybe it's a thing that the municipalities themselves may not have the money, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we won't be paid, but we can be paid via other solutions. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
But we need to find a way of getting Eskom to be paid. But then even going forward, as we do that, we do not want to get to a situation where 5 years down the line, we have now, each one of these municipalities have built up again another debt with Eskom. No, whatever solution we come up with, it must be a permanent solution to this problem.
You've taken a hard line before where you've attached assets of municipalities. Yeah. Is this an avenue that you are?
It's always available to us. And I mean, right now we are in court with the city of Johannesburg, with Tswane, you know, and when those court processes go all the way, we have to do what we need to do. Yeah.
And in terms of the biggest offenders, when you're looking at metros, are you concerned at all when you have got metros like the city of Johannesburg, city of Tswane, Mangaung, for instance, being in line to be the biggest offenders?
Yeah, we are concerned. Yes, because of the size.
Mm.
But our concern is a general concern, where whether you are owing us 100,000 or owing us 1 billion or 5 billion, it is the behavior that is a concern. You know, it's the behavior, because we as this country, we really do need to get to a point where we respect the contracts that we sign. You know, when we enter into some kind of an arrangement, you need to be able to honor those contracts. And that is all societies that are progressing. You'll find that at the core of that is the rule of law, is the respect of contracts, people pay their bills, you know. And so, because at the end of the day, the reason why we are just worried about that general behavior is that we look at institutions and communities, look at them and say, oh, if they can do this, then why can't I do this, you know? So we need to set examples, in particular organizations that are strong, that have got means. We need to set those examples. So that's the issue, that when we become concerned about the values that we are inculcating in terms of our society.
I want to talk about NESA, you know, I think it's on the 5th of September. That's when Parliament will be debating your application to NERSA to have
It's 5th of what? September?
5th of September. Okay. I think it's the 5th of September or the 2nd. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the exact date, but it's early on in September when that discussion will happen of the 36% increase next year. Now, when I come to you as a layman and I'm saying I'm already paying an exorbitant amount to Eskom, mind you, Eskom for a number of years hasn't been able to fulfill its own obligation towards me as its customer, which is provide me electricity. Why should you feel that I should pay you more?
Look, I think now we are theorizing because we do not know what Eskom will be, the application of Eskom into NESA. We none of it. Okay, everybody is discussing this thing, but at the end of the day, Eskom needs to still submit its application to NESA. You know, it's still not have done that. So that's where. So we're basically having a discussion based on I don't know what. You know, so that's one element. We have gone through this process. It was not the first time that we're going through the process of Eskom doing its application to NESA. you know, and it's come up with whatever number. But NERSA's responsibility is to make all of those considerations that you are talking. That's their job, you know. They need to look at it and look at affordability and look at all of these things and then make a decision, having factored everything, right? So if you go back in terms of history, you may realize that there were many instances that Eskom asked for X and NERSA came back and said, you are going to get Y, you know? And I think that's how, and when NERSA does that, they also do public participation programs where people go, you and me can go and have our submissions there. So that process is still yet to come. You know, so I think that some of the discussions that are being had now, they are being had much, much, you know, it's like so
premature.
Premature. Mm. We should not be having these discussions now.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your financials,
yes.
Chair. Mm-hmm. The Financial Mail in July reported that Eskom may record a loss of 15 billion this year,
mm-hmm.
Slightly better than last year's 23.9.
Mm-hmm.
And
you call that slight? 8 billion. 8 billion is a lot.
That's true.
No, I'm just joking. I hear you.
And then, you know, government has extended Eskom's lifeline by taking on the 254 billion of its debt. Do you foresee a time where Eskom will be able to stand on its own without the bailouts from government?
Yes. I mean, this is the whole point of a turnaround. You know, many of us were looking at this turnaround as we should not have load shedding.
Mm.
That's not our view as the board. Our view as the board, we would have turned around this business once we've done gotten rid of corruption in the business, once we've done, you know, reduced significantly the levels of debt that is having, you know, once we are able to be in a position where we deliver profits for the business and we're able to do that over a period of time, you know, then we'll say that we would have turned around this business. So then the question is, you're rightly asking the question, is Eskom ever going to be able to stand on its own 2 feet? Our view is that yes, and that is going to be actually soon, you know. I'm going to share with you some of the key drivers of the financials of Eskom. One of them is the fact that we're having load shedding. It's actually a bad thing for Eskom because it means that you are selling your product less. You know, there is a demand for it, but you are not available to supply it, so you are losing sales. So just the 4 months where we have not been having load shedding, it has significantly increased our sales, you know. So that's the top line, your top line. So that's very important. Increase, you've got lost opportunity now because we're not doing load shedding. That opportunity is. Again, the second driver, because the fleet is more reliable, which means that we are using less diesel, right? You know, last year alone, the last financial year, we used 33 billion rand of diesel. And everybody would be like saying, it would be like, how can you be? And that was by design. We did that because we wanted to minimize the negative impact of taking stations, going and fixing those power stations. When you are fixing them, that those units are not available to produce power. So to try and minimize the negative impact to society, we used what is called the open cycle gas turbines that use diesel to minimize that. So we had planned at the beginning of the financial year to use 30 billion rand of diesel. We ended up using 33. Right. But now you have done most of this maintenance. You are bringing these machines back. They are more reliable. They are just going. The reason why we're not having load shedding now, which means we are using less diesel. So you are saving, you know, saving from last year. Last year used diesel, like already this financial year, which starts in 1st of April. We have saved on previous year 10 billion rand. just this 4 months, I mean 5 months, we have saved 10 billion rand on last year. So those savings, where do they go? They go to the bottom line. So improve our, you know, last year we used 33 billion. We were not even going to get to 10 billion this current financial year. You know, so that amount of 20 something billion rand of savings, it helps with the finances of Eskom. Then the third element, which is an important driver as well, is because our debt, we've got this huge amount of debt, as we have been helped by the National Treasury in terms of reducing the debt, which means that our interest charge is going to come down because the principal debt is coming down. So we are doing savings there on the interest. There's a saving on diesel. And on the top line, you've got the revenue that is increased because we are doing no load shedding. A combination of those things should get us very quickly to a position where Eskom does not is profitable.
I want to talk about sabotage, which is a subject which dominated conversation around Eskom a lot in 2022 and even before. And when you speak about corruption, it also fits into that.
Yes.
You've said in the past, I think with Mr. Nxumalo being introduced, that you have had to look at capacity as well. And some people have been removed and there's been arrests. But how far is your fight against this animal that is sabotage in Eskom? Are we at a point where you can say that, you know, corruption at Eskom, you are trying, we know that you are trying to alleviate it, but where are you in terms of that fight?
Yeah. I would say I would try and separate corruption
and sabotage.
And sabotage, because those are not the same thing. And a lot of people, in people's mind, there's this sabotage thing. I think it's highly exaggerated, the sabotage part.
Okay.
Not the corruption.
Not the corruption part.
Not the corruption. The sabotage part is really, really exaggerated. So that. I mean, it's not something that we really, you know, are seeing. We see people, it's generally companies that, let's say, they are doing trucks, they are delivering coal to the mines using trucks, right? And now we are having these conveyor belts that are taking coal from the mine directly to our power station, which means if those conveyor belts are working, we're not now going to be using other people to deliver by road, right? Then you start to see people trying to burn, pouring petrol on the conveyor belts and things like that. So what we then did, one of the key interventions was to deploy technology. So we're using drones to monitor and these conveyor belts and protect them. And we've been able to catch a few people trying to do that. And we've taken some of those through the court processes, you know. But as I'm saying, it is this thing of Eskom employees going out of their way trying to break the machines, I think is highly exaggerated.
The reason why I think this conversation around sabotage started was because it was started within Eskom itself by the former CEOs, as well as the Minister of Department, the Minister of the Public Enterprises, who said that there was deliberate sabotage of the country's energy system and equating it to treason.
I would say that some of these things are with theories than really, you know. Yes, we've seen, like I'm mentioning what we've seen when it comes to, but what I used to hear at the time was that, you know, some of the people would pull out the plugs and do this and make sure that the machines are not working and, or throw stones instead of coal. You know, all of that is, I think, it is really, really exaggerated. But this corruption is something that is there, and it has largely been there in that environment, and how we have, at least up to this point, managed to address it. Corruption always thrives in an environment where there's chaos, where there's chaos, and chaotic environments you'll find where you know, you have a leader that is really not paying attention to the things that it should be paying attention to. For example, if you ask me, Lizeka, that I should be delivering to you 2 tons of coal, and I'd come and deliver those to you, and you do not go and check whether did I really deliver the 2 tons. Is it even coal that has been devoured, or is it stone? If I don't pay attention to that after you have just delivered, I only notice that 6 months down the line, it says a lot about my own way of managing. You know, I'm not managing this environment properly. So by just putting the right leaders that pay attention to these small things, which actually can end up being big things, you pick it up, a problem immediately that's been done, and you address it. That's leadership. You know, you need to have processes. You need to have checks, you know. And you'll find that in some environments, you'll have leaders that really were not paying attention to those things. You know, they're not paying attention to the standard operating procedures. You know, this is an engineering firm. There are certain ways of doing things. If you are running a plant, you know, you need to go and take a reading after 2 hours. Go and do this and adjust that thing after 4 hours, you know. And if you are not doing those things, you are bound to have, you know, the plant not performing the way it was designed. And the reason why people may end up doing their own thing is because there is no leadership in the environment. I'm talking now in the power station.
Yes.
In the power station. So that change that Becky did, you know, that change brought a lot back of the discipline that was lacking in some of these environments, whereby people, now they know what they need to do. If I have to, after 200 hours, I need to change that shaft and do this and do that. People ended up following that. So a key element of also just reducing corruption is to have the proper leaders. And proper leaders would put together the right kind of controls so that when things are not happening the way that they should, they're able to pick them just like that and take action. You know, so that's one element. But there are still, as the board were working, there are still many, many other areas where there are gaps. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be the one that stand on rooftops and tell the whole world what is it that we are doing here, because many of these things are quite sensitive. You need to make sure that we protect, you know, our strategies. But this is one of the areas that, as this board, we're focusing on. And what I can say that in the office of the new CEO, he has created a project management office just to focus on consequence management and investigation of some of these cases to make sure that we execute, we implement action quickly.
There were some investigations which were done during Mr. Derita's time.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Derita alluded to them on a number of occasions during interviews.
Okay.
Of corruption, widespread corruption, and syndicates which had infiltrated ESCOM. Have you found that to be the case?
When you talk about, I'm not sure what kind of syndicates, but some of the things that we're picking up in terms of our own work around the corruption is that some people are working in groups to try and do certain things. In order for you to be able to execute and get your company outside to be paid, and to be paid exorbitant amount of money, huge sums of money, you've got to have a lot of people working together in different parts of the organization to execute that. For something that, you know, you create a purchase order of something that is not there and you get that purchase order to be approved and all of that. In order for you to execute that, you need to have a group of people working together. So those are the things that, that's why I don't want to go into too much detail. Those are the things that we're monitoring, where we can see, some of the activities, we're targeting some people, you know, and we can, we've started to see that, you know, people are actually working in syndicates.
I understand the sensitivity of your investigation, Mr. Nyati, and I don't want you to compromise it in the same breath. But I do want to ask around, because corruption has been part of the fundamental problem at ESCOM.
Yes.
I mean, ESCOM was the crux of the state capture report by the public protector as well. When you went into ESCOM, were you and you found ESCOM, you familiarized yourself with the workings of ESCOM, were you concerned and are you concerned that there's a prevailing corruption in networks there?
You know, based on my own experience in where I've worked, what I've noticed that is generally a few individuals that are driving these things within organizations. Most employees are committed employees who are ethical, you know, and, you know, yes, you have then a group of people that are driving this. So that has been my experience in the past. And I thought that it would not be any different in an ESCOM environment. And now that we have been in this environment, you can see, you know, that's another thing. What we're seeing is the level at which the people on the ground are reporting things now. That's very important. People are reporting things. And it says a lot that about the people themselves, which means that they can see this is something that is wrong, that is happening, and they are prepared to, you know, take the risk to go and report it. And it confirmed my own view of things, that most people actually are really, really good people. And this is what we've found in ESCOM. Yes, we've got 45,000 employees. Out of those, maybe 5% is not the good percent. But in terms of numbers, that's a huge number if you've got 45,000 employees. So yes, but it does not deviate from the general view that in all organizations, it's got this small group of people that end up doing these things. But if you continue not to have consequences, there's nothing that is happening to them, that group continues to grow in terms of size, because people can see that, oh, okay, you can get away with this thing. They can see the lifestyles of these people. We're doing the same job, but look at the kind of things that you have. Then it starts to, this, that is why we've put together this very important project management office in the CEO's office to deal decisively and with speed with these matters as they come up. We do an investigation, you take a decision, if somebody has to go out or with the hawks or whatever. So that is what we're doing.
I then want to ask you, Dr. Nyati, if you have ever felt, because it became almost like ESCOM was a war zone where even the president had to, you know, deploy the army at ESCOM due to allegations of sabotage and corruption and so forth and these syndicates that I was talking about. Have you ever felt fear for your life in your job?
Honestly, I have not felt unsafe, but maybe also given my role, I've got protectors, so mm-hmm. there's that element to it. So, but there is nothing that I've visited, you know, because I used to read that people are walking around with bulletproof vests, and we've been almost all of the power stations. We've never seen any of this need to do that. So I just do not understand where some of that came from, but there must have been, I'm sure there was a need for some of that, but we have not seen that need.
I want to get to political interference.
Mm-hmm.
It was the former ESCOM chair, your predecessor, Dr. Malegapuru.
Yes.
Mukhaba, who was talking about the former DPE public enterprise minister.
Mm-hmm.
And his words, where he said, Minister Gordhan is a minister with a penchant for interference and at times undermines the people he appoints. And he was speaking about himself and the board at the time. Mm. And this is not something that has started with him. It was said quite in several occasions about how the ANC and politicians were interfering in ESCOM and they were overreaching in ESCOM. Mm. With the relationship that you now have with government as this new ESCOM board, have you felt any interference from the principals, from the shareholder?
Yeah. So let me just, before I answer that directly, that question, let me just give you a sense of my own experience as a CEO of companies. One of the things that is important if you are in that role is what I call stakeholder management. You know, you need to know the key people that will help you to be able to do your job and do your job well. And you have to manage those relationships. You know? The other thing that one has to know is you need to also know your boss. You know, what is the style of my boss? You know, what is his leadership style or what is her leadership style? And try and align with that style. Some people are people who like detail. And if you are not giving those people information, you may end up in a situation where, you know, every now and again, what is going on? What is going on? But, you know, had you taken the time, you would have understood, oh, this is how this person operates. Then I need to work with him or her like this. Other people are hands off. If you keep feeding them with this information, you are actually irritating them, you know. So it is the job of the leader to have an understanding of the people that he or she is dealing with, you know, and those people, they may all, like in my case, I had different ministers that we're dealing with, you know, the Minister of Public Enterprise, Minister of Energy, you know, the Minister of the Minister of Electricity, and also the Minister of Environment and Finance. All of those are different. Their way of working with us so different and largely influenced by their own personal styles. If I treat one the same way, as I would be making a huge mistake. So it is so important to pay attention to that and then give people the information the way that they want to receive it. You know? So I had to do that, like I always do in almost all jobs. And then for me, you know, I remember the first two or three weeks of us on this board, you know, we're having board meetings. Each time the stage of load shedding goes up by God. One, then we call a board meeting. I say, but what is it that you are going to do, really? You know, so we had to say, please give us the space, you know, give us the space so that we understand what is it that the systemic issues that this company is facing. So once we, and again, when you look back, you realize that there was a respect. Okay, we'll give you the space, you know. And then we went there, we did our work, and then we got a clear view of what the issues are. Very, very important to do that. So because now you can start to assign responsibilities. you can start to ask for help, but that help is informed by what you have found out. You put people to use. You know, it's that thing of managing up, you know, say, okay, we've got this issue here. Can you help me with this? The person become busy with things that are going to help you, you know, and people, and that is what we should always be able to, should do. You know, people want to be helpful. Everybody wants to feel like they are helping, they are useful. You know, we need to find ways of making people feel like they are helping, you know. So when we reach out to many of these, and I worked very closely with Minister Pravin Gordhan, many of the changes that happened at an employee level within ESCOM were largely based on the discussions and the help that I got from them. Things like the salary increases. You know, for 5 years, there were no salary increases for employees of ESCOM. They had removed the bonuses. You know, all of these things, the responsibility for the pay of executives, it used to sit with the shareholder. That's something that should sit with the board, you know, and now it's back to the board. Who made that? It is him, you know. But you need to know what to ask for. You know, say when you have done your analysis, the demotivated staff, this, and this, you are going there, you're presenting your case, is informed by data. And people get it. So, oh, okay, I will help you with that. I'm going to do this, you know, so you remove the blockages. In the appointment of the CEO, you know, people said, oh, no, how can the board not be involved in the appointment of the CEO? You know, that decision is made by the shareholder. In our case, it was not. You know, I was part of the team and the ministers that sat together and we chose the CEO, you know. So what I'm saying is that my experience was different. But I think that experience was informed by our approach as the board of saying, give us the space. We want to understand the issues. Once we understand the issues, we engage you. We engage you on how you can help us address these issues. And people in the process feel like they are valued. People feel like they are helping and they go out of their way to try and help because there's clarity in terms of what you are looking for.
I think, Chair Tatunyati, looking at your time, you're almost at the end of your term as the board chair, 2025, I believe.
Yeah, is October 2025.
So then what happens? Want our Jesus.
Our term ends in 2025. And you know, if you're doing a turnaround, you do a great job if at some point when you leave, things don't fall apart, which means we have built things that will live beyond you. So this is what we're doing as this board. You know, for example, the decision to take the responsibility for the salaries of the executives and put it in the board.
Yeah.
Now the new board, wherever it comes, they are the ones that will be able to have this thing. So those are changes that are not going to go away just because we are not there. You know, the ability to set incentives for employees to drive behavior. All of that was not there before. Now, the board has got that responsibility. Sitting with us, we're able to give these incentives to the executive, the employees of ESCOM, depending on what the priorities are. In any year, you then set your incentives to drive for employees to go and achieve the goals that you have set for that year. That responsibility now rest with the board, you know. It can go on and on. These are structural changes that we have created that will live beyond us. And that's what you want, you know. You want exactly that. You know, you don't want to depend on people said, oh, okay, that, you know, baking challenge, he has to always be around, you know, or it has to be Lwazi Kokwana, he has to be around. No, it has to, even if we're not there, things must work. You know, the way we have reinstilled the discipline of maintenance in ESCOM, you know, you have to do this and this time and do this and do it has to happen even if we're not there. Because once that is back in terms of the culture, you can be assured as the public that, you know, things are going to go smoothly. So our job is to do exactly that. When we put together like this office that we're talking about in the CEO's office, that's a structure that will outlive us. They will it has people that are employed to drive this agenda. It will be there beyond us. That's what you want. You don't want to depend on a few people.
I understand that is your legacy as the board.
Yes.
But I still want to know what happens in 2025. Will you come back if the offer is made to you?
Well, I do think that we still have a full year to make that decision. So I cannot tell for sure, you know, because they certainly, in my case, was brought in. I had other things that I was focusing on, you know, so I need to look at what's happening in terms of my life at that time, you know, but certainly I think the employees of Eskom have surprised all of us. They have risen up to the occasion, and I have no doubt now it's not driven by us, this thing. It's not driven by us. It's what I call a virtuous cycle. Mm-hmm. It's now on its own. It's like you can see that there's this competition between power stations, you know, a great competition. That's what you want. A competition around excellence, you know, that's what you want, you know. And that way, you know, you can leave, you know, things are just going to go up until it doesn't.
I think my parting shot, your parting shot rather, is you know, I'm sure I when we were in the lift, for instance, when we came across a colleague of mine who said you're doing an excellent job, this is, I'm sure, something that you hear every day.
Yeah.
But I imagine that it's much more meaningful when you hear it from family.
Yes.
What does family say about your job at Eskom?
Yeah.
This leap that you took.
So one of the things that, you know, when I look at, I've got four values that I've kind of driving my life. You know, it's excellence, it is fairness, it is integrity. The last value is family. Family. So you're asking a very important question, you know, because there's virtually nothing that I do without consulting with my wife. You know, for example, we had long discussions around my taking this job in Eskom, you know, and I have her full support, you know, but of course she was concerned, like all of us were reading all of these things about Eskom. But certainly she was very clear about what we're trying to do and the importance of this work. I think she's one of those people that continue to support me, whether I did a great job or not. She was always going to be supporting me, but she is particularly proud, you know, of the work that we have done as a team. You know, one of the things that happened, just a side thing, when I got appointed to this board, and I come from a Tabas, and that's my village. So the people of the village said, "Oh my God, thank goodness, we're not going to have any more load shedding." Oh. Because now we've got somebody, they're going to do load shedding for everybody else, but not for so they were excited that you are going to fix load shedding, but at least for them, there's not going to be load shedding. So it would have not gone well in line with my fairness value of saying, you know, whether you're a leader or not, you need to experience what everybody else is experiencing. So the key thing that we had to do is to drive that we make sure that we eliminate load shedding for everybody. So they are particularly proud, the people of Amthatha. They are particularly proud, the people of my village, you know. And we were discussing St. John's College, very, very proud people. So I mean, for them it is Mteto, but for me, I know the reality is actually, you know, it's a team. Yeah, and certain.
Thank you so much for this time. It was so enriching.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that is where we end it in this episode with Eskom Chairperson Mteto Nyati. Thank you for listening. I'm Lizakathandwa, Digital Politics Editor at the Sunday Times. Goodbye.